We'll look at another question here. And these are truly at random. Wow, it says this is the one I was actually waiting for this question because somebody told me, and then I said it's just at random, and we put it in there. So I'm going to go ahead and ring the singing bowl, and we'll do a moment of meditation. I'll bring us out of that with a prayer, and we'll get going with our last session for this afternoon. God of the happy, joyous, and free, we thank you for this place, for the fact that we are surrounded by beauty in all directions. We thank you for the realization of that as the gift in our lives here today and in this moment. We'd ask for the awareness of your presence, not only in this moment, but in our lives as we go forward from here throughout our day. We recognize you as our one and only guide. And we thank you for filling us with your love and allowing that love to overflow from us this afternoon. Thank you. So I said we'd ask a question, and then I said I'm just picking these at total random. But I actually picked the one I was hoping to find because somebody had told me they'd written this question, and it was, how have you dealt with anger? I just had answered that in this last question but I would add that, you know, prayer and meditation has been the key, I think, element in stepping up the amount of prayer and meditation that I do that has been the thing that I have found that has calmed me down by far the most. And what I do is I do contemplative meditation primarily. That's just something that I found, which is meditation where you can do a little reading. And one of the guys that was a spiritual mentor for me, and only for a very short time because I met him, and then unfortunately he passed away. And I hope that none of you become my spiritual mentors, because they seem to drop like flies in the story. I just realized that. But this guy's name was Pálmi Ingvarsson. He was an Icelandic guy and lived in Seattle for a while. And was a sober guy and had amazing sobriety. But I went to him one time and I said, Pálmi, what is it that you're reading? I kind of wanted what he had. And he said, well, it doesn't really matter too much. You know, books find you. You don't find books. And he said, but since you asked, my deal is the infinite way. Joel Goldsmith was the guy's name. And Joel is another guy that's written a lot of books. And I've never really been able to grasp completely. I never really got a lot of traction with the infinite way stuff. But Joel Goldsmith's writing is fantastic, and I'm really glad I was exposed to it. But that day, the same day he's telling me, books, you don't find books, books find you. But since you asked, was The Infinite Way by Joel Goldsmith. And so I go home that night, and I'm laying in bed with my wife Shannon next to me, and usually on my side of the bed stand is or books on, you know, always spiritual material and kind of heavy stuff. And as far as Shannon's concerned, it's heavy stuff. And then on her side of the bedstand is like Joan Collins, Hollywood Wives, you know, and, or some story of some rock star or something, you know, some life of somebody and that's had, you know, a glamorous life. And And so I come home and I look over on her that same day. I look over on her side of the bed, on the bed table, and there's a book there called The Parenthesis in Eternity by Joel Goldsmith on her side of the bed. And I just about fell out of bed. I was just like, and I told her, I said, where did you get that book? And she said, well, it's the strangest thing. I went to see my therapist today, and this therapist that she had at that time probably knew my wife better than anybody on this planet, even me. I mean, they'd had a really close relationship, and this lady had been fantastic for my wife in her sobriety. And so she knew Shannon very well, and I'm thinking, why would she give that book to Shannon? And I said, so she said, yeah, she just said she was compelled to give me this book, so she gave it to me. And there it was, this book that and so I read the Parenthesis in Eternity. Shannon, I don't think, ever read The Parenthesis in Eternity because it's one of these deep books, and that's the way Joel Goldsmith is, and that's probably the reason that he lost me a little bit and I never got traction. You know, he's very much like, here's all of existence, and then here is this parenthesis, you know, this little, if you take this big circle that means all time forever, and you put the tiniest little dot on it, and then you put that dot in parentheses, then that dot is your existence, you know, like this idea of how insignificant, you know, we really are in the complex, you know, that's kind of the Goldsmith thing. You know, it's just amazing when you open yourself up to that kind of thing. And when I'm in those low spots, it seems like that's usually one of the things that brings me out of it. Like, I count on it. Like, I'm going to find some book or somebody will... somebody will give me a book. My friend Glenn gave me a great book, and I think I'm going to mess up the title here, but it's called The Buddha Within, or what's that? Is that it? The Buddha Within? And it's just a fantastic book, and usually when I'm in those, somebody will show up and say, hey, have you seen this book? And it's become a pretty great piece of our group, you know, one of the things that we do in this. I have a meeting, we meet once a month, the guys that I sponsor, and a few of the guys that they sponsor, but mostly this particular group. We have another group that's all of the grand sponsees and on down the line that we meet once a month, two online. But this particular group is a much smaller group. It's just the guys that I sponsor that I'm active with and that I have personally worked steps with. And in that group, you know, accountability is a big piece of what we do there. And we also, a big piece of what we do is outside literature. So it's not an AA meeting, and I don't run the meeting. I secretary the meeting. I get the meeting going and read our little deal, and it says something very similar to what is in the West Los Angeles Men's Stag group, that we don't ever talk about anything that's in that meeting. We don't talk about who was there. We don't talk about what was said. We don't talk about that. Even with each other, we don't share that stuff. We certainly don't share that stuff without the permission of the person that mentioned. So we do have a piece where we will say, if you have permission, in other words, you can go to the person and say, can I talk to you about what you said, because it had a, you know, in big impact on me. Would you be willing to talk about that with me? Each month, somebody else from the group brings some literature, and oftentimes it's stuff that I hadn't seen or something that somebody's into. And then we have this accountability piece, and it's what I want to spend the time on here in our final session this afternoon. We used to do it in the beginning of the group. We would have accountability, which means that we would just go around the room, and if there's something you need to be accountable for, people will say, well, I've been doing this, or I had this experience, or I got mad at this person, or I said things that I was, you know, unfair to my wife, I treated poorly, or much more serious things than that. But it's still a part of our group. At the end of our group, when we're done, we ask the question, has anybody got anything that they need to reveal to the group? And people are really good about staying accountable to each other. In our book, we have a piece in the sex inventory. You know, we do our resentment. We do our fear inventory. We do our sex inventory. And for me, I don't get into the nuts and bolts of that here at these retreats because it would be and nothing that's wrong with doing that, but there's so many big book people in this kind of a group here that it's very easy to find. So how you write inventory is how your sponsor that everybody here has mentioned, and I don't think we had anybody that didn't have a sponsor, write the inventory the way your sponsor tells you to write the inventory. That's important. So when I did my inventory, I was so sure that when people found out like how poorly I'd been treated in life, that this guy that I'd asked a guy from the that was one of the leaders at this big book workshop that we did, and that I'd gone and done a retreat with. You know, I'd gone up and done a retreat, and Joe H. and a couple of people that he brought led this retreat when I was in early sobriety, and that was the first real, after that third step prayer that I talked about with Al, that was the first time we'd got up to that part of the book. We were getting ready to do our third step, and I did a third step with a big group of people like that. But one of the things that I found is that I used to say it was some of the time or most of the time. And now I can say it's in every case because I've really thought about it. And I found that in every case, when I've seen somebody who seemingly has had the experience and had the spiritual awakening or our Dr. Silkworth calls the psychic change, the spiritual awakening, the spiritual experience, what Carl Jung called the revolutionary change, the personality change, our spiritual appendix 2 calls it the personality change, which is sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. They're all talking about the same thing. And when you see somebody that's had that experience, and then you've watched them go back to sleep and relapse and be back out drinking and drugging, you think, how is that possible? I can remember the first experience I ever had with that in early sobriety. I was down in the hall, and there was a guy there, and I still run into him once in a while. I'll run into him at a different events other than AA. I'll just happen to see him on the street or something. And he's never recovered, but he had like a lot of time back then, you know, which was, he had like 8 or 10 years or 13 years or something. He was a prominent figure in this group. His name was Ron. And I saw Ron one time. I just walked into the group. I didn't know that this was a thing that happened. I mean, Ron was always just right on the money with the message and the recovery. And I walked in and I just saw him sitting at the meeting. I walked in and I said, "Hey, how's it going, Ron?" He says, he looked at me and he said, "I'm all effed up on these painkillers." He just looked right at me. And I looked at him and I could just see this guy that was taking all these painkillers. I could just see it. I could see he was loaded. And it just completely blew my mind. I mean, it just shook my foundation to its core that a guy like that would relapse. But since that, I've seen it a lot of times. Lots and lots of times. I've seen it with people that do these retreats. I've seen it with people that do AA talks, people that seemingly have a great message. And I've seen them with 30 and 40 years or more of sobriety go down that path and start drinking, or it's, you know, oh, I hurt my ankle playing by the sober softball, and next thing you knew, I was all screwed up on these pills. And so what I found was that when I've been lucky enough to talk to these people, when they come back in, if they're lucky enough to come back, it's always the same thing. Always the same thing. There was something going on in their personal life that they were not being accountable for. They were stealing time and money at work. They were lying about their hours. They were lying to their wife. They were cheating. They were messed up with some partner in a way that they didn't want anybody else to see the person that they were with. They had gambling problems. They were addicted to pornography. They were They had financial problems. They had huge financial debt, and they were playing a game with credit cards, and they were playing a life, and that they weren't revealing to anybody that, my God, I've been overwhelmed, and I'm about ready to go completely financially under because I'm trying to keep up a personality that's here when my financial situation is really bleak and I've run up all this credit card debt. These kind of things. So we're in the group that I come from, we're really dogged about being accountable to each other. And I am just accountable to these guys as they are to me. And so I've written something up on the board. I wrote it in a little bit different color pen this time. And hopefully you can see that. If you can't, you can go up and take a picture of this. So in the 12 and 12, so Bill wrote in the 12 and 12, and Bill wrote the big book when he was about 3.5 years sober. He was 4 years plus sober when the book was finished, which is great. And there's a line of thinking that says that that is the evidence that this book was divinely inspired, is that Bill just held the pen. He just held the pen. And we know that because there's things that are in that book that people who are 3.5 years sober don't know, and 4 years sober. And I used to subscribe to that idea. But then I think it's important for us all to remember we are living at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous that is unlike any time ever, and it was completely, I think, unexpected by the founders of this program, and that's that we have such a large percentage of our members that have 30 and 40 and 50 years of sobriety, or 25 years, 20 years and above. We have a lot of people that are in that, and nobody ever saw that was coming or what that would be like, that people would be making these long-term sober and they would be making these new discoveries and finding new things, and that AA would evolve in this way. And one thing that I believe has happened is that we can unintentionally give people the idea that you have to have this large amount of sobriety in order to have one of these deep and effective spiritual experiences or to really get some traction on it. But we know that's not the case. It's like the story that I use is that I use the Joan of Arc story as an example. For those that know a little bit about the story, I think if you go to this gift shop and you can ask them, they would probably have something to sell you about the identified Saint Joan of Arc. I haven't even been in the gift shop, but I'm guessing that because they're Catholics and the Catholics made Joan of Arc a saint, that you could find a little medallion or a little piece or something in there. Joan of Arc is the patron saint of rape victims, of people who suffer. And when she was 12 years old, St. Michael came to her in her vision, and St. Catherine and St. Margaret came to her, and she couldn't read or write, never been to a day of school in her life, and said, "You are going to free the French from the English invasion." The English had been kicking the crap out of the French for 100 years. It was the 100-year war. Kicking the crap out of them. Dominating them. And so the short part of that is that somehow she got to the religious leaders in the French regime and convinced them that she had actually, they asked her a lot of questions about, well, how do you know, and what did they say? And these religious leaders ended up going to the prince and telling the prince that, hey, this girl really is the real thing. We've schooled her, we've asked her all the questions, and that she knows things that nobody could know about. She told them, yeah, go look at this church and go under there and under the altar at the church where the priest stands. Go remove all of that rock, and you'll find a sword underneath that. And they went and they did that, and they found the sword. And this is all recorded history. And she became the youngest ever leader of a modern, and this was modern by she was in the late 1400s. The youngest ever leader of a military force in history, of a large military force. She became the supreme commander of the French army. And she fought in the battle at Orleans and kicked the crap out of the French. She had this mind where she could tell people what to do and where to go and how to position everybody, because she was getting these messages through the stuff. And she freed France. She freed France from England, and they recrowned the king. And she was injured in battle, and she took an arrow through. She built her own armor. She built her own armor for her horse. She did all of that, and then they captured her, and they put her up for trial. And the church and the king and nobody was to be found, because they were afraid with what would happen. Everybody turned their back on her. And, you know, the crime that she was convicted of was wearing men's clothing. Because you couldn't, they were modern in their way of thinking. They didn't have war crimes. If war was war and that was it, everything's fair. But if you did something that the Bible said, wearing women's clothing, and they burned her at stake. And when she died, she was 19 years old. And so I think if you're here and you got 3.5 years sober, you should be able to write the kinds of things that are in this book. There's nothing that keeps you from being as, you know, there's no limits on spirituality that limit you in some way from doing that. You know, to taking some pen to paper to put it down. And I'm not telling you to go out and rewrite the big book, believe me. You know, I've been down that road as well. So so I've written some things up on the board. So Bill was 18 years sober when he wrote the 12 and 12. And he'd had a new experience. And he puts it down. And if you'll read the 12 and 12, and especially step six and 7, but he mentions it throughout, he really came to this conclusion that he was 18 years sober, and he was dogged by all kinds of problems in his personal life and problems with depression. And he came to this conclusion that his main problem was that his instincts gone awry. That these God-given instincts for sex, security, and society had been given him. That were God; those are God-given instincts: to have sex, to procreate, to have pleasure, to enjoy that, to have a God-given instinct for security, for a certain amount of financial security, emotional security, and security in our health, and that in society and family, career and community, that we should establish some form. Our problem is, and Bill found out his problem was, he just demanded way more than his fair share of this stuff. That I demand more than my fair share of sex, security, and society. That's what brings me down years sober, when I start demanding. And you got to remember when Dr. Bob passed in 1950 and Bill passed in 1971, you know, there was a lot of years in there that was AA's extreme growth, and Bill was the only living founder in AA. When Bill would go to a convention, he couldn't be in the convention when a speaker was speaking, because the speaker could never get started because everybody was mobbing Bill to get him to sign their big books. And people were thanking, "Oh my God, you saved my life," by the thousands. People, he was adored. He was, you know, Bill got royalties from the big book, you know, which they gave to he and Dr. Bob and their spouses. And then when those ran out, the royalties from the book now all go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But Bill got royalties. He had money. He had got his dream place, you know, that was provided for him, where he could write. You know, he had his own little, separate from the house, his own little writing lodge at Stepping Stones, where he wrote the 12 and 12. He had everything that anybody could ever ask for, and yet he realized that he was still demanding more out of Alcoholics Anonymous, that somehow he wasn't getting enough credit. There was never going to be enough sex, never enough security, never enough society to provide for him those things that would make him feel okay. That he was asking far too much of these things. And then he came to that conclusion that he would put these unreasonable demands on other people. Unreasonable demands for sex, unreasonable demands for his position in security, that more money, more emotional security, pay more attention to me, better health, I don't ever have to be sick, I don't ever have to go any of that stuff, society, more family attention, more success in career, and what does the community, which includes Alcoholics Anonymous, what does that think of me? And when he didn't get those things, he would ask these unreasonable demands, and we can all put ourselves now in Bill's seat when I make those unreasonable demands on other people and it fails me. Bill's experience was, here comes the depression. That was his experience. That's this guy who was 18 years sober, that had everything and was just allowed to be a writer and do things for AA and travel, and he was just another human being. You know, there's a famous letter that somebody wrote Bill. It was very critical of Bill, and Bill responded to the letter, and it's this letter's just, it's fantastic, and he just explains to him that, yeah, you know, your disillusion with me might be new to you, but it's not new to me. Many people have become disillusioned with me, and I want you to remember that I'm just a drunk trying to get better in AA and just trying to be an AA member among AA members. And I hope that you'll remember that. He had had that realization. And it was that that started bringing Bill out of his depression. You know, in the 19, you know, the 1955, I think, was the, you know, Bill was sober a while. He'd been around a while. So this is what I want to offer you. We're going to take our break here, but I want to offer you this. So on this side of the room, we're doing an exercise here. This is homework. And if you don't want to do it, don't do it. If you want to get the most you can out of this retreat, do some of the things like write to prayer and do this. We're going to start on this side. You're going to be number one, and we're going to go this way. And everybody's going to call off only on this side. I want to get number one through whatever we end up with in the back. And remember your number. It's going to be really important. You have to remember your number. So we're going to start here. So we got 29 numbers on this side of the room. So we're going to start in the back corner there and go forward. So we'll start in the back and just circle all the way up to the front. You start with number one again. Okay, so I know we got 29 on this side. So the 28 and 29 on this side of the room, you guys are paired up. Okay? The other 27 of you, you find number one on this side of the room. You find number two on this side of the room, and so forth. So you will find number 27. You're going to find 27 over here. you guys are partnered up. And what I'm going to ask of you is we have a new ideal for our future sex life in the big book. I'm going to ask you for a new ideal for sex, security, and society. And I broke each one of those into three spaces. Sex is pleasure, reproduction, relief. Security is financial, emotional, and health. Society is family, career, community. So so we've got, I just want you to write this out and just write one sentence. That's all you need. One sentence. If you want to write two or three, you can, but just one sentence. What do you think about sex for pleasure? So I would say for me, you know, sex for pleasure, I'm only going to be having sex with my wife. You know, I'm in a committed relationship. There's single people here, and I understand that. And you don't, that doesn't, we're not here to judge what's right and wrong. Just what is it for pleasure? Well, I think that I should, you know, we should both be having pleasure maybe at the same time. It'd be probably the best way to approach that. That reproduction. So I'm 61. I'm not going to have any more kids. That's my new ideal. I'm done having children, but I'm open to having, you know, children come and be at our house and nieces and nephews and grandkids in the future. Relief. What do I think about that idea of just using sex for a way to relief? You know, that we do that. This is a men's retreat, and I think women are the same way. I don't think there's anything different, but sometimes it's just sex is just a way to use sex as a relief. But we want to look at that like, can I do that without causing harm to other people? Security. Financial security. What's my new ideal for financial security? Am I going to rely on God? Is God more important to me than money? You know, I had we're bumping up against our lunch here, so we're going to get out. But, you know, I had amends to make. It was $14,000. I went up to Alaska, got on a fishing boat, sober. And it's the only time I did that. And I went up sober, and after that, I decided I was just going to work in management. But I went up, and we had a trip, and I got back from the trip, and we were gone months, and the trip was kind of a bust. But I got my check. It was exactly $14,000, and I was back at the car lot, and I knew I had to make this amends. And I took that money, and I went and paid that guy his money back, this guy that I'd burned for $14,000. I'd borrowed money on this guys that I needed something, and I would be paying him back quickly. And I knew he had just come into a big pile of money, so I went straight for him and blew up our relationship. But there was the first time in my life that I ever put, I realized this after the fact, it was the first time in my life I ever put God, my relationship with God, ahead of money. I really wanted to go get an apartment. I wanted to get a car. I wanted to get off the car lot so I could get a girlfriend and all those things. I mean, but I knew that if I did that, I was going to get drunk. I knew it. I knew I got it. So I put God ahead. Emotional security. What's your new ideal? Is it to be peaceful? What's your new ideal for health? Do I need to, is there things that I'm not doing that I should be paying attention to my health? And that's definitely something that's in my inventory. Society is, how about family? What's family? What's going on with my new ideal? What kind of family member, father, son, brother, sister, uncle, should I be? What about career? Where's that? Am I going to, what's that look like for me? What's my new ideal? And it'll be different if you're younger, older, retired, just starting a career in community. That includes AA. What kind of a sponsor am I going to be? Just look at that. But just write a few sentences, and then you're going to share that between now and when we get back together. And if you don't do that, it's fine. But make time at some time during this weekend to get together with that person. And it's a random deal. There's no coincidences. There's no chance events in mathematics, and so you're paired exactly with the person that you wanted to be paired with. And somebody, would you pick out a just a random number that's between 1 and 27?
13.
So I'm going to be with the 13. There'll be three of us since there was an odd number here. So I'm going to be with who's 13? So I'm going to do this with you. So you and I, and who's the other 13? So there'll be three of us in the 13. So the 13s all, we'll get together at some point and decide when we want to. I'm going to go write this out myself during the break. If you don't do it during the break, do it after the deal tonight. If you don't do it after tonight, do it, you know, get up early in the morning and do it. But get together with your partner, figure out when you're going to do it. And it's lunchtime. We're going to take our break. And I will say there's people going to the beach. I know there's a hike down to the beach. I heard about some people. If people doing stuff, let other people know at lunch that you're doing that. So if there's people that don't do stuff, I'm going to probably hang out close by. I'm going to do a little walk. I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to write this stuff out. And our next session is going to be at 5 o'clock. So we've got a lot of free time. We're going to see each other here at 5 p.m. Okay, everybody?